Look around. You can find cars like these on AutoTrader. New cars, used cars, electric cars, maybe even flying cars. Okay, no flying cars, but as soon as they get invented, they'll be on AutoTrader. Just you wait. AutoTrader.
Hi, everyone. I'm Hillary Kerr, and this is Second Life, a podcast spotlighting women who have truly inspiring careers. We're talking about their work journeys, what they've learned from the process of setting aside their doubts or fears, and what happens when they embark on their second life. Today on the pod, we're bringing back an interview with the co-founder and CEO of Good American, Emma Greed. Emma co-founded the beloved denim, activewear, and clothing company with Khloe Kardashian in 2016 with a clear vision to build a brand based on inclusivity, offering sizes 00 to 24, inventing the size 15, more on that later, and featuring models of all shapes, sizes, colors, and backgrounds. Since we first released this episode, Good American has also launched dresses and maternity categories, not to mention their online shop now features products shown on 15 different sized models to help customers find the perfect fit for their unique shape. I think it's genius. But before moving to LA and founding the game-changing brand, Emma ran an entertainment-based marketing agency back in her hometown of London. This episode is a fantastic example of how to use your unique perspective and skill set as an asset when you're approaching a new challenge or changing lanes in your career. I hope you enjoy Emma Greed now on Second Life. Emma, let's take it back to the beginning. What did you study in school and what did you think you were going to be when you grew up?
It's a very good question and a very good place to start. So the first thing to say is school for me wasn't so much of a breeze. I wanted to be a great student, but I just didn't have it. You know, when you like, I wasn't good at like focusing. I wasn't good at like sitting in class. I was a restless student. And in later life, actually, as an adult, I found out that I'm quite severely dyslexic, which was something that back in those days...
You didn't know?
No, I didn't know. And actually, I was a brilliant reader. So for me, it was like, it came out like in math and, you know, in language, but not, you know, they typically like identify dyslexia when you're reading and writing. And it didn't come out that way for me. So, you know, looking back, hello, newsflash. I was dyslexic and I probably could have done with a little bit of extra help, but school for me wasn't great. And it wasn't until I got to the London College of Fashion, where I studied business, that I really actually found people that understood some of my issues and worked with me a little bit. But at that point, you know, you're 17, you're in central London, there was work, there were boys, it was all a little bit too alluring. So again,
a few distractions.
There were so many distractions. So I started college and very, very quickly found myself, you know, doing some work placements and just decided I'm going to go to work.
So were you always drawn to fashion? Was that something that you cared about when you were little?
Always, always. You know, I come from a pretty grim part of East London. And I think for me, you know, looking at the time, it was like literally just buying fashion magazines. And I was obsessive about it. I would buy the magazines. It was the days of the supermodels. So it was all about Naomi and Claudia and Kate, like literally Kate, love Kate. And I would like cut out their pictures on the runway and file them by designer. I was obsessed with the ads. And for me, that was like escapism. I don't think I realized that at the time. But, you know, if you live in Plaistow and it's all pretty grim and there are some not so nice things happening around you, that was just like the idea of these shows happening in Paris and Milan was like so alluring for me.
So tell me about your first sort of adult job.
Something proper
that
job.
Where you were paid or where you felt like you were actually making a step along the path of your career.
Absolutely. I mean, I had a lot of jobs. You know, I worked from a very young age, but the first real, you know, in retail, in cafes, waitressing, like I always kind of felt like I had a real need to make money. But the first time I found myself in a real job, a real non-work placement paid job, was for a company called Inca Productions. And they, at the time, were like the preeminent fashion show production company in London, and they did lots in Paris and New York. And, you know, my job was working with them and building, you know, you're like building the fashion show. So there's absolutely nothing glamorous about it at
so
all.
You were in full production.
Full like, production.
Like ordering executing sets or like setting up the backstage?
Oh, I mean,
or...
the lot. I have carried more benches and, you know, set up makeup stations backstage than I care to remember. You know, it's like I did the whole thing. But, you know, your job was ordering pieces of Perspex for, you know, the catwalk. And it was one of those weird jobs because you would spend 3 months actually creating this show and bringing somebody's vision to life. And then it would all come down in 10 minutes. You know, the show, the lights would go up. You wouldn't watch the show because you would be backstage, which was like, what? Why am I here? And then, you know, the whole thing would be packed away. And I found it quite soul destroying. I remember being like, what have I just spent my life? You know, and you'd work these ridiculous hours. And so in the same company, I then started working in fashion show sponsorship. And that was really where I started to understand where my skills were in negotiation, in, you know, contracts and working and being like a detailed orientated person. And that was really where I started to figure out what I was particularly good at.
So how did you figure that out? Were you great at contracts in general? That wasn't your background.
No, that was
like, how did you figure that out?
It's really, you know, for me, it was trial and error. I am naturally, like in England, we'd call it like a wheeler dealer. I am a person that can, you know, sell anything. And I think that I just had that naturally. Yeah. You know, that was what...
We call that a hustler.
A hustler. I'm a hustler.
You got some hustle.
Exactly. I'm made of it. And so for me, you know, when you're working with incredible talent that have these amazing ideas and yet they've got no money to be able to execute them, for me it was almost like I've got to find these guys what they're looking for, and I've got to do these brand partnerships. And you would pretty much almost do whatever you needed to do to be able to raise the cash. And so
walk me through that from the beginning. Like, give me an example of a designer who you were working mm-hmm. with and what the problem was in terms of like what you needed financially.
Absolutely.
And then who the brand was that you connected them with. Is what that process is like.
Absolutely.
Because I'm so curious. I've never heard that whole story from start to finish.
It's so crazy. So for me, you know, at the time, we were really working with the great and the good of the British fashion scene. So it was everybody from Alexander McQueen Julian McDonald and Matthew Williamson and Giles Deacon and Erdem and Christopher Kane later. And that, to me, was a dream because you literally were working with these insane and incredible talents. But of course, you know, their businesses were something very different at that time. We're going back, you know, over, I don't know, 10, 15 years ago. A good example, I mean, and I've worked on so many partnerships, the good, the bad, and the ugly. But you would often be working with hair and makeup brands, right? So there's an obvious synergy there. You've got girls walking up and down the catwalk. There's this huge backstage experience. It would be like, how do you get the look with L'Oreal, with MAC? And so they were really simple backstage sponsorships where the hair or makeup brand would get to showcase what their looks are, their colours of the season, on the most incredible girls, working with the designer. And then it would be like putting together a basic sponsorship package. There was a transaction there, of course, for money, which would help the designer. But for the brand, they were getting, you know, to showcase whatever it was that they were doing in this incredible kind of, you know, fashion week environment. And so it was a win-win all round. And now I think there's probably not a show that ever happens without hair and makeup sponsorship.
Totally.
There were also some horrendous deals that we did, you know, that
like
were
what?
I don't know, maybe with like, you know, sanitary products and girls, you know, I may have sent one or two girls marching down the catwalk with a mobile phone, but you know, that you did what you had to do to get the money. And sometimes you'd have to be very creative with those partnerships. But you know, where I was good was really in the negotiation. How do you take somebody who's incredibly creative and has a vision for their show, which quite frankly has nothing to do with what this brand is trying to do,
right?
And then you take what the brand is looking for, which is engagement with an audience, and put the two things together,
because they sometimes have very opposite desires too.
Always, I would say.
And I feel like that's got to be hard too, especially like a young and up and coming designer also probably has like very firm vision about what they're, you know, like creativity is everything. Maybe they aren't as well versed in the ways of the
world.
That's
where I come in.
That sense. And then you have these brands that also probably need some convincing, because like, I'm sorry, Christopher Kane was not always Christopher Kane. Like, Erdem wasn't always the brand that it is today, especially a decade ago.
Yes.
Those were swings for some, in some cases too. So how would you bring both of those things together?
It's really about having a fundamental understanding of what both parties are trying to do. And actually, I always believe, you know, where art meets commerce is there are some great things that happen. And so I think some of the things that maybe started out the furthest apart were actually the things that turned out the best. Because when you've got two people that actually do need each other and two parties that need each other, you'll always find a way. It just, you know, sometimes you needed some creative storytelling and then some creative paperworking because you've got to contract it, right? It's like, at the end of the day, it's a transaction. So how do you put that on paper? But then again, that's about building relationships and you build trust. And, you know, once you work with designers that really know that you have their best interests at heart and you build up, you know, clients and brands that really know that you fundamentally understand what they need to get out of a partnership, you're able to do things. And so I was able to take some liberties.
Got it. Okay, so you're doing fashion show partnerships. Mm-hmm. That's going really well. What happens next?
So thankfully, I managed to find myself in a great situation where I was offered a really great job as like business development director. And I remember thinking to myself, ooh, that'll sound good on a business card. And I was a little confused about what it meant. But I knew that, you know, for me, it's always been about, you know, get close to the good people. And I happened to meet these guys, Jens Greed and Erik Torstensson, who had something at the time, which was called the Saturday Group. And that was, you know, it was an agency group. They were an ad agency. They'd just bought a PR company. They were doing shoot production. And it just felt like wherever I looked in London, those guys had something to do with it at the time.
Everything,
you know,
cool.
Just like literally everything cool. And some stuff that was not so cool. But then like, was like, that's an amazing client. Like, what? You have H&M, they're your client, like that's incredible. And so when I met Jens and Erik, what they did, you know, they kind of brought me on board with one, you know, they were like, this is going to be your job. You're going to work with all the great, you know, designers that we have, and you're going to take some of the bigger brands that we're working with, and you're just going to do what you do. And actually, after a while, it became really apparent that I kind of sat on my own within the agency. And they were like, we're going to build your own agency around you. And again, it was one of those things that I was like, well, that sounds great. You know, yeah, I'll be a managing director. And I remember Jens saying to me, you know, you're going to be in charge of your own P&L. And I was like, cool. And I went home and Googled, like, what's a P&L? And I was like, so naive. It's unbelievable when you think about it. But the idea actually was that the world was changing. The type of partnerships that were becoming more and more prevalent were more talent-based partnerships with celebrities. And I'd been doing that at that point for 5 years. I knew how to take a, you know, an individual, a client, and a brand, and put things together and create a contract from it. So we decided that we would start a new agency with me at the helm. And that was where ITB, my first business, was born. And that was amazing for me because it was everything that I knew, but then so much stuff that I had to learn. I had no idea about Hollywood and how, you know, how that works and the hierarchy of Hollywood. And actually, you know, I say this a lot, but it was really my naivety that led me to doing some great things because I had no respect for how things worked, right? Yeah. I had no, and not a lack of respect, that's the wrong way to put it. I had no idea how things worked. And so when you don't know, you just make it up as you go along. And, you know, because of that, I just didn't have, I had no fear. I would try to get people on the phone that, quite frankly, were not about to take my calls because they were running, you know, gazillion dollar agencies in Hollywood. And I would just bash the door down until I got them on the phone. And they'd be like, dude, I'm doing a movie deal. You have to talk to the commercial department. And I'd be like, but aren't you the decision maker? Like, isn't this going to come back to you? Shouldn't we talk? Should I come and meet you? And it was really like that kind of tenacity and just bullishness and naivety that got me, you know, or got ITB, my agency, doing some great stuff.
Did you have a team?
No.
It was just you?
Just me. After about 6 months, I was doing a bunch of deals and I was, you know, like dying in contracts. And they were like, Emma, you do Renault, we have a legal team. And I was like, in track changes, like doing everything myself. I was like, oh, yeah, yes, I knew that. Of course I know. Yeah. And then they forced me to take an assistant. And at that point, you know, you're so precious and you have this, again, stupid idea that only you can do what you do. And I had no idea about like nurturing people and
or delegating.
Oh, delegate. I mean, delegating. That took me a long time to learn.
It's something I still have a hard time with.
I'm much better at it now.
I think it's something that like is an endlessly difficult struggle because yes. you, when it's something you care about, you still want to touch it.
Absolutely.
But at the same time, no one else can learn unless you learn how to do that.
Absolutely. And you know what I learned with Jens and Eric, because they were, you know, at the time, you know, they were art directors. They were two guys that had set something up. And so everything that they touched intrinsically smelled and felt like them. And at the same time, they had an agency, which at the time was maybe 30 or 40 people. And I remember sitting with them and going, how am I going to do this? And they were like, Emma, if you want to do stuff and build this big agency, you're going to have to scale, which means you're going to have to train people. You're going to have to teach people. And I was like, yeah, but I'm just, you know,
I'm too busy.
The way I do it. Yeah. And it really took me a long time to understand. And I think the thing that I was very fortunate with was the fact that I was in this agency environment and I was literally seeing these guys do it. I was seeing them train people. I was seeing the work come out the other end being just as good. And I'm so grateful to have had those two, because in hindsight, they taught me so many things just being in their proximity. And You learn on the job. Yeah. And boy, did I learn.
Okay. So you're starting to put these Hollywood deals together. On a side note, I do think that there's something really great about not falling into the trap of, well, that's not how it's done, darling.
Yeah.
Because that's something for Catherine and I in the digital space. One of the ways that we feel like we were lucky in growing our business is no one knew. It was the Wild West. So you could make things up. You could do things the most efficient way, the most effective way.
Absolutely.
Not in this very prescriptive way that you might have to go about something if you were in print or if you were in broadcast or whatever
may be.
So you get to sort of innovate in a new way. What was one of your early deals that you got really excited about, and how did you make it happen?
So the deal that really, really put my company on the map was Natalie Portman for Dior. And at the time, yeah, I mean, Natalie's still Natalie. She's still one of the best and most brilliant actresses in the world. But she'd never done a commercial agreement. And bear in mind, she's been famous since she's 10 years old,
right.
You know? And I managed to figure out who her manager was, this incredible woman who I still know now, Aileen Kashishian. And again, wouldn't really entertain me and take my call. Natalie doesn't do commercials. This isn't something that she'd be interested in. And, you know, I knew that Dior had a lot of values that were really in line with Natalie's. Natalie is a vegan. She's very famously, you know, against wearing leather products and animal testing. And she, and at Dior, what they were doing was really, you know, extracting all the animal derived ingredients from their cosmetics and starting afresh and using their scientific kind of prowess, if you like, to make makeup better. And so I had that information, but you can't explain that to an agent over the phone who's got like 20 seconds
right.
to listen to you. So I managed to somehow, I badgered and badgered. I got a meeting with her. I flew all the way to LA to have what I'd been told was a 20-minute slot. And when I got into the room, and this is no word of a lie, it was when that Chanel navy blue nail polish was like the thing.
Yes.
And I had it on and she had it on and we were done. I spent like 2 hours in Aileen's office. And yeah, I mean, ironic, actually, we're in Chanel nail polish.
Thanks,
trying
Chanel.
To do a Dior deal. But, but you know, that was really it, because she was like, oh, look, we've got the same nail polish. And we just had this immediate connection. And I got to spend time with her and to explain why, you know, Natalie Portman was so perfect for this thing. And so, you know, snap my fingers, 12 months later, we had a deal. But, you know, I learned absolutely everything I needed to learn about not just how to do a really, really high level, global, really big deal, but actually like what Hollywood was all about and these relationships, because then in came the lawyer and in came the agent. And of course, if you're Natalie Portman, you've had the same incredible team around you. And I learned all about this community in LA that actually still now, as I'm in a completely different business, is so intrinsic to the way business happens here, right? It's like people have been working together for a really long time. And you think it's the same in New York and you think it might be the same in London. It's not. Here, it's like mafia. It's totally different. And especially in the entertainment world. And so that for me was a great learning curve to really understand how things were coming together and what you needed to do to even be part of that community or to be taken seriously by that community.
And who you needed to get on board.
Totally.
Because so oftentimes you need you need, let's say, four people's buy-in for any particular project, but 100%. Identifying who those four people are, I feel like, is half the work, because you might think it's this person and you're like, no, that person seems like they matter, but it actually doesn't. Like, we need this person who's going to be the squeaky wheel who I have to get to figure it out.
Yeah,
That's so crazy.
And it's different because at the end of the day, you know, when you work with talent, they're people, right? They're not everything is the same. And you can't say it's always the manager, it's always the publicist. It's, you know, I've done deals that have gone via stylist. I've done things that have gone via makeup artist. So it's really about that individual. And that's what's so special about being in that world of, you know, talent procurement and working with brands in that way, because there is no rate card. There is no way of doing things. You've just got to know everything that you don't know and find a way around it.
So you're starting to work with lots of people in Hollywood at this point. What are some of the differences between doing deals in the UK versus doing deals with Americans, just out of curiosity? Or is business just business?
No, I don't think business is just business. And I think actually one of the reasons ITB was able to be so successful is because we had a very different approach. There were lots of big American players in that space. And actually when you're working with, you know, old Parisian houses like Chanel or Dior, or indeed if you're working with H&M, which is, you know, Swedish to its very core, the approach of like, pow, 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 here comes Brad Pitt, like doesn't work. Like they're like, so, whatever. But it's true. I think that, you know, sometimes, you know, the approach that we had was very different. And again, it's like, you know, we talk about like Europe, you know, and there's just no such thing. There's France and Germany and Sweden and England and, you know, a billion other countries. And actually, what we did really well was understand intrinsically the different in those markets. And you don't have that so much in America. Of course, you know, there's localized news and, you know, and everything can be extremely local. But for the most part, America is probably, you know, and I talk about this with my husband a lot, like the world's best branded country, right? You know exactly what it means to be an American. There's an American dream, there's an American way of being, and it comes with like fist punching and you can do anything, like you can be the president, like me, right? I can be the president. You know, it's like there is that understanding that like that in the rest of the world. And so I think for me, I really had to change a lot when I started doing business here. And you have to have a different approach and a different way of being. And it's extremely local. And there's also that other thing of when you work in America, there's a little bit like the rest of the world doesn't exist. You know, it can be a little bit like that. Whereas I think if you're an outsider, you have this whole idea of what international really means. There's like this huge world outside.
So you're based in London at the time when you're starting to do all of these bigger Hollywood deals, mm-hmm. international deals. At what point did Good American enter the picture?
So Good American, I started thinking about it when I fell pregnant with my second child. So we launched the company October 2016. It was probably early 2016. I started kind of having rumblings. And I knew for a long time I wanted to do something different.
You only started thinking about Good American.
Oh, yeah.
Like that six, same year?
Yeah, literally. I mean, honestly, it was one of those things. It came together so quickly. And I remember speaking to Chloe, like there was no name, there was no anything. So it was really one of those things that came together in 6 months. The idea, I had started doing a lot of equity-based deals on behalf of talent. And so I again saw this shift. You know, I went from working with designers and artists to working with talent, very, very straightforward ambassadorial deals. And then they moved into, you know, everything became about influencer. And so the deals got like much smaller, but then much broader. So you'd be contracting hundreds of people instead of spending like gazillions of dollars on one person. And then again came this like huge shift where everybody wanted equity in everything. And it was almost like, great, well, let's give them equity because like,
you know, then
the company's nothing, you know. And also it was a bit of a buzzword. Nobody really knew if things were going to work. So it just became that kind of time. And I decided that, you know, I thought that would be good to do that type of partnership for myself, that it was time to actually get out of, you know, doing really great things for brands and try to do something myself.
Something so, really great for yourself.
Yeah, you know, and it really was because it was the thing that I was like, what do I really believe in? Where do I think there is opportunity? For me, work is all encompassing. It isn't something that I kind of like put down at 6 o'clock and return to tomorrow at 9. And I love that because my work is my hobby. And so I started thinking like, what do I really care about? What issues are things that I can speak to and feel good about speaking? Because, you know, it's like I'm 35 years old. I don't want to waste my time. I want to do something that I was carrying a baby girl. I was like, I want to do something like she could be proud of. And, you know, after a while, doing celebrity partnerships is, again, a little bit soul destroying. You know, that's why I started working with charity, because you're doing, you know, really amazing partnerships for people that already have lots and lots of money. So I was like, okay, I need a balance here. But Good American was one of those things where I just wanted to do something I could feel really proud of. And I thought that women of a certain size were really underrepresented in the fashion industry. And that's where the spark came. I was just like, why are we even still having these conversations about, you know, because I would do a lot of casting. We should make sure we have one black girl. We should make sure we have one Asian girl. And it's like, are you kidding? Is this the conversation that we're having in like 2000 and whatever it is? Like, this is nuts. And so in the beginning, Good American was like this set of principles in my head before it was even a denim company. It was like, this is the way I'm going to do things. And then I'm going to figure out exactly what it is. And that at that point is when I started talking to Khloe Kardashian.
Tell me about your meet cute. Because I feel like every set of co-founders has like a funny meet cute.
It's really funny because, of course, I met Khloe through her mom. So
as one
immediately,
does.
Yeah, of course.
I mean, you can't do business in Hollywood without knowing Kris Jenner, right?
It's impossible. And if you think you are, you're probably not actually in business. So Kris, I love, and she's one of the better managers that I've ever worked with, because, you know, what you see is what you get. With Kris, you know, she intrinsically knows her clients. She makes really,
she made
really,
her
yeah, she like really knows them really well. But, you know, I think that counts for something because Kris has a very clear idea of what she is. I don't want to say selling because that sounds ridiculous, but she understands, right, the people that she is representing. And so, you know, straight away, she doesn't waste any of your time going, oh, you know, we'll figure it out. It's like,
maybe.
No, that will definitely is not her. That's yeah. never going to work. That isn't what she cares about.
She gives you a fast no.
Completely.
Which,
a fast no.
By the way, as
more
a business
often than
person is what you want. You
isn't
don't
it?
There's nothing worse than a
That's
slow
what
no.
You, of course, there's nothing worse. And with Kris, I always respected the fact that she was extremely honest, really straightforward to work with, and absolutely true to her word. So when I called her, I tried to give
Had
her the spiel.
Had you guys been working together?
Oh, yeah. I mean, okay. I'd done lots with her, and
so
I loved
knew.
Her. Yeah, I knew her really well to the point where, you know, I would have lunch with her in Paris. When she was in Paris,
like for fun.
She would say, yeah, she would be like, do you want to have a lunch? And of course, when Kris asked you for a lunch, you're like, yeah. And you go to L'Avenue, and then, like, you know, maybe Kendall would turn up, or maybe Kim would turn up, so you'd have lunch with all of them. And that, for me, was, like, super glamorous and lovely at the time. And again, you know, it was work. It was like, she's one of the big managers for some of the biggest clients, and you should go and have lunch with Kris. That makes sense.
So you had a long-standing, fruitful working relationship
Absolutely.
And personal affinity for
Absolutely.
Kris Jenner.
Yeah.
And then you went to her and said, I have this idea for
Yes.
this company that I want. I don't know what I want to make, but I want it to be, you know, body positive
yeah.
and
size inclusive. And I think it should be, you know, it should be something that is, you know, impactful. Like, I was like, this is a company that's going to be on a mission to change things and to do things really differently. And she said, oh, well, you know, you would need to sit down with Khloe. And immediately she said, I'll arrange that for you. And the next thing I knew...
So you hadn't met Khloe at this point?
No, I'd never met her. I'd admire, you know, I'm a huge fan of the show. And having done this professionally for a long time, like looked at talent, fundamentally understanding what they stand for, what their affinities are, I saw Khloe in a way like she's super honest. She has this kind of vulnerability about her. She was going through this, you know, body journey of her own at the time. But to me, she was everyone's favorite Kardashian, right? She's the girl that, you know, she has great things happen and bad things happen, but she's so steady. She just always remained herself. And I thought, you know, despite having this like weight loss that she went through, she was always the same person. Like you didn't get the sense that she'd changed. And I thought to myself that from a values perspective, she was the type of girl I'd like to be in business with. I was like, she stands for everything that I'd like this company to be. And then, of course, there are all these other things, like Chloe has massive social media and she's on this show that's been going for 16 seasons. So,
and she's stunningly beautiful.
She's the the most beautiful. And she has a really nice bottom, which in jeans is not insignificant, right? It's like, you know, so it's like one and one makes 20. So I was very clear. And I remember also, you know, doing for myself what I'd done for lots of clients before, which is like, who else? Who's my list of people? And I kept coming up with nothing. You know, I was like, I actually just going to try and make this work and then I will come back. And at the same time, I was trying to raise money. So I kind of like had said, yeah, I've got, you know, Chloe's going to be into this. So then I go and see her and she got it so quickly. I had like a, you know, like a keynote presentation and Chris and Chloe were in the room, but then Chris left because it was at my husband's office and she went down to pick some stuff from Frame. And so she left Chloe and I and we just chatted and she was literally like finishing my sentences. She was like, I got it. I understand this. I've had these problems that I can never get stuff that fits. And my sisters are always sent all these cute things. And she just had all of these stories. And as she's speaking, I'm like, oh my God, like this is somebody that really understands it. And she said to me, yeah, like I'm in, like let's do it. And at that point we had nothing, no name. We decided like denim because we thought, oh yeah, we can definitely make a change to a product that's, you know.
There's a white space in the market.
There's a huge white space.
Size inclusiveness.
Absolutely. And we really both love jeans. She was like, I have about 100 pairs of jeans. And I was like, I have about 100 pairs of jeans. And so it was really that
so
simple.
Jeans were your navy blue nail polish.
Absolutely. Jeans were my navy. Absolutely. You got it in one.
So you said you were raising money at the time. How did that go?
Do you know, it's really interesting because for me, working with a lot of brands, and as I have for the past 10 years, I had a lot of goodwill. And I think that's really something that, as a businesswoman, it's important to build up that goodwill and to know where you've got it. You know, too often I hear people say, well, you know, such and such kind of owes me a favor and maybe I should have a conversation. And I'm like a person who knows who owes you a favor. I do people favors because
you
I want to create that.
Someday.
Yeah, it's like I want to create that goodwill. It's like that. I believe everything that goes around comes around. But I'm very like, you need something, like I'm going to help you out. Absolutely no problem. And, you know, I'm going to call you one day when I need something.
Yeah.
And again, I've gone all American. Yeah, I've gone all American in that way, because that is a very US centric thing. And so for me, it was simple. I had Jens and Eric have been my business partners twice over. Subsequently, I married Jens. So he's
husband.
In the middle of all of that, I actually started dating the, you know, my board member slash boss 10 years ago.
And we've casual. Now
yeah, super cash. Couldn't happen now, could it? You would never meet somebody at work and kiss them in the elevator. They were my first port of call. I was like, hi, guys.
I need to raise some
money. I've got this project. You guys know a little bit about denim. And, you know, they were like, this is a no-brainer.
On a side note, we should say that they also are the founders of Frame.
Yes, they
denim.
Are. Yes, they are.
Just as an FYI. Just as if you didn't pick
important.
That up along the way. So we
got
hugely successful.
Jeans in the family.
Very beloved brand.
Absolutely.
FYI.
And, you know, what was so great about them is, again, you know, they were money that came with a set of expertise and an understanding, and they wished me really well as well, which is another thing that you can't, you know,
can't
value enough. No, it's so important that you've got people in your industry and around you that are gunning for you. And so Jens and Eric have been great business partners of mine, continue to be great business partners of mine. And then I went around, you know, my immediate group, clients, people that I knew, people that I thought would have intrinsic value in the company, and managed to raise the rest of the money.
Had you raised money before?
Never. No.
I mean, that's kind of a crazy thing when you go out and you go on your pitch
yes.
and you have to do your song and dance in front
Absolutely.
Of all of these people, some who you know, some who you don't. Did you enjoy that process?
Yeah, again, because I just took it back to what I, you know, what
you had a
I'm good
story.
At. I had a good story and I also had a real reason for the company existing. I kind of built a business case that was like, look at what's happening in the world right now. And you would literally switch on the TV and you would hear something that would be directly in line with what I was pitching. And so for me, it was about not just a great idea and a great mission and eventually a fantastic product, but it was happening at the right time. And timing really is everything. In my job and in my companies, I've always pivoted. It's like, yes, I had ITB for 10 years, but it did 3 or 4 different things, you know, and we kept adding and developing that service
Followed
offering.
The money.
And then, yeah. And really, it's like, if you'd have asked me, you know, are you going to be working with influencers and predominantly, you know, striking agreements for Facebook and Instagram? I'd have been like, I'm sorry, what? Like, what are you talking about?
Because Instagram didn't exist.
It didn't exist. And nor would you have thought about it in that way. You know, you're going to be working with someone who has 30,000 followers or will everything be Hollywood stars? I'd be like, I'm going to bank on the Hollywood stars, you know? And so the tide had turned. And I think that, again, Good American just so happened to be the right thing at the right time as well. So investor money wasn't hard to come by. It was about having the right set of people that I needed because I knew that we would have something that would go beyond my set of expertise very, very quickly.
Got it. So you partnered with Nordstrom.
Yes.
And I remember thinking it was such a brilliant idea that, first of all, the line comes 00 to 24.
26 now.
26
yes.
now.
Yeah, we're adding.
All right, well, launched at 24.
Absolutely, you're
and
right.
And you demanded that the entire line sit together.
Yes.
Which has never been done.
Absolutely not.
First of all, how did you get to Nordstrom and slash think it was the best fit? I think I know why. also, what made you decide that that was the strategy of having it all together?
Absolutely. So what was really important to me at the beginning was we had planned that this business was going to be predominantly direct to consumer, but I always buy my jeans in a store. And I thought, you know, what was going to be so important because so many women struggle with buying denim. Like, you want to speak to someone. You want to ask some lady in a fitting room, like, what does this look like? What do you think? You know, can you get me another size? Like, I'm looking for this or that. And so that idea of customer service was so important in the beginning. And so when I started asking around, you know, it was always like, Nordstrom are excellent at customer service. You can
That's
take something that, you know, you bought 3 years ago and you can take it back to a Nordstrom and they will take it back. I also had employed 2 nannies at that point and they both worked for Nordstrom previously in their teenage years. And I was like, there's something about this Nordstrom training that really, you know, appeals to me. So I started to get a sense of what their values were. And I was introduced to Pete Nordstrom and to Trisha. And they were like, we get it. We're going to go away and figure it out, how we're going to get everything in the same place, how we're going to display it, how we're going to make this make sense, how we're going to train staff. You know, it was a huge undertaking for them, but never an issue. They got it from the second we pitched it.
They came from a place of, we'll figure it out.
We are going to figure it out and we're going to put a lot of energy behind it. And to this day, they're so important to our business.
So you started with denim.
Yeah.
But you've expanded.
We have indeed.
So how did you know when to expand into which categories? Like, do you test? Is it hunch? Is it a combination?
It's a real combination. And again, going back to Nordstrom, one of the things that you don't see when you're only retailing your own goods, right? You don't speak to the people in the same way. And that was one of the things that I was like, how do we institutionalize feedback from our customers in this company and use it beyond a review? You know, you look at the reviews, you take the stars of the reviews, you figure it out. But I was like, no, how do we make that something that we then base decisions on? So that was a business problem that we had to figure out for our .com. What Nordstrom were telling us very early on is like, this is great because now we're serving a size 20, 22, 24 customer, but we've got nothing to give her on the top. And if she doesn't want a denim jacket, you know, it's like, where's the t-shirt? Where's the what? And so, you know, that was something for us to figure out. Like, how do we outfit this woman who's coming into the store and there's nothing else for her? Because now she's there. She's ready to buy. So bodysuits were something that, you know, it's not even a category. Bodysuits was a Khloe Kardashian thing. She's like, I love have jeans and a bodysuit. That's my jeans and a t-shirt. And I was like, that is a good line. Right. And I am going with it, Chloe. And so so we decided that we'd make bodysuits. And I hadn't put on a bodysuit since I was like 12. You know, I was like, I think like the clip in the crap, yeah. like you're gonna we're gonna do that. And so we started making these bodysuits and we were looking at fabric and we were looking at shapes. And then we started, you know, well, if we're offering all these different sizes, then what about butt shapes and what about fabrications and what do women want? And so that's how we then started speaking to our customers. And Chloe is the master of this. She knows how to communicate with her audience. So she was like, just ask them. And we were like, oh, yeah. You know, we had a few hundred thousand followers on Instagram at the time. And so we just started asking people. And the most amazing information comes out when you actually ask women. It's so nuts, like so crazy. I remember we were thinking about new hardware. We started with silver. We were like, we'll probably do gold, but let's ask them if they want gold or gunmetal. But of course they came back and they said, we want rose gold. We would never have thought about doing rose gold hardware. But of course that's the jewelry all the girls are wearing yeah. and they want something that matches their jewelry and picks it up. And it was so interesting because when we went to the supplier, they were like, rose gold hardware? A, it's really expensive and no one does it. So we had to like make rose gold hardware, but we knew it would be a great thing because the customers had asked us for it. And then you
and
can
start... they're going to market it themselves because of they're so pleased gonna... because they're part of the process.
Thank you, you answered exactly. And so it's such a win-win, but it's again, it's something that has to be institutionalized within an organization because you can ask questions, but do you actually take that information and make changes within your business? And so for us, that feedback loop has been something thing that we've really had to figure out, like how that really works.
Wow. Okay. So some practical stuff.
Yes.
A lot of the people who listen to this podcast are enjoying their first career, but they might think that there's something else and they want to make a leap or they want to make a pivot, or maybe they want to make a second pivot, whatever it is. And they're trying to figure out how to know when the time is right, how to read the room, read the signs, and make that leap. Since you have made so many smart pivots in your career, what advice would you give someone who thinks, I want to do something else, but I'm not quite sure?
I think you have to give yourself permission, because you kind of wait. And I think about some of the things that I've done that maybe I would change in my career. And they were times when I was almost like waiting to be given permission. Like, I really want to do this. I really feel like this doesn't work for me. Like, I hate this part of my job. And it's like, you're waiting for some justification to come along. And it's like, you just have to stop and give yourself permission to fail. And a lot of women are just not that good at it. And I say women because I do think that men rebound in a different way. They don't take it to heart necessarily in the same way. If you are really thinking about having a change, like just give yourself permission for it not to work out. It suddenly makes any scary part of a transition okay, because not everything does work out. And I think what I've learned and what I've seen so much in my career is all the great people had a disaster at one point. No one ever has this like perfect story where they went from this to this to this. It's like there was always something that went gnarly and they messed up and it didn't work out, or they were fired, or they were unfairly
Steve
judged.
Jobs.
I mean, seriously, right? It's and it's always that way. So I think just, you know, be prepared for things not to work out and to not take that personally.
Right.
I think that's really important.
So the financial piece of this is also
yes.
part of it
Huge.
Too.
Always has been for me.
When we started our company, I've always said I was very privileged because I was single. My parents are in good health, have their own financial situation handled. I wasn't supporting anyone. I didn't
right.
have a mortgage. I didn't have, you know, health debt. I didn't have college debt. I was lucky.
Totally.
I was broke. I was dead broke, but I wasn't.
There was
in
nothing.
Trouble.
Yeah. You were just at zero.
Exactly. So it's like, it was just basically like, can you feed yourself? Can you make rent? Can you make your car payment? And then everything was fine. So it was low risk for me at that moment. What if someone isn't in that position? Do you think that you should have savings? Do you think that it's important to have a backup plan? How did you approach that in your life?
So for me, I never had any savings, and I come from a single mother who had four kids. So there was no safety net. It was like, you're basically on your own. I was on my own from like 16 in terms of on my own, had to fend and pay for myself. you have to, you know, for me, I had to be willing to work every single day. And I see this huge difference in my friends who really partied a lot in their like late teens, early 20s to the others that like knuckled down. And I often, you know, hear people go, oh, you know, you're working really too hard. You should have some fun. There is no choice. Like, you need to be willing to put the work in, because there's always somebody that's willing to do that around the corner. And my experience, for me, it's like I work 7 days a week for probably 6 or 7 years. That was because I was interning, yet I needed to make cash, but the cash that I made wasn't enough. So I had to supplement that by doing like a job at night. And that was just what it was for me. And I was completely fine with that. So I think that, you know, you're always going to need to pay bills, but you need to be willing to dial things back a little bit. And that was always fine for me, because I just thought, you know, at a certain part in your life, you've got to figure out what's more important, you know? And so for me, it was like, I just want to find the right thing for me to do. And I'm willing to do that with not very much money, and I'm willing to sacrifice. And I think in this day and age, you know, we're told so much that like, you can have it all. And it's like, you know what? No, you can't. I don't know anybody that does. I really don't. You know, the luckiest, most brilliant women that I know that on the surface have it all go, yeah, but you know what? I haven't had sex with my husband for like 7 months. I'm like, oh, well, interesting. Or like, you know, haven't seen my kids for 3 weeks. And so that notion of having to have it all, you can have it all, but just not all the time. And so just like be willing that something's got to give. And if that's like, I don't know, your haircuts and your waxing, or you can't socialize as much, or you know, can't do anything because you're working all the time, just be willing for that. It's like, it's not great all the time. And I just think we just have to be honest with ourselves a little bit. And everybody's had struggle. Everybody's had times that have been less good. And I think we should just talk about that a little bit more.
Exactly. Speaking of which, so I feel like in this very Instagram pretty filter world that we live in,
oh, yeah,
people don't talk about the hard stuff as much. So what is an example of something that was tough in your career that happened, and how did you get through it?
That's a good question. There's been lots of tough things in my career, actually. I'm somebody that, you know, I pride myself on being really loyal, and I think I confused, you know, loyalty and my own ambition a little bit. Like, I stayed in jobs for a bit too long, and I get resumes all the time. I'm like, oh, look at her. She, you know, jumped from this to this to this. And then I, you know, I judge it, and I'm like, no, like, that's can be a really smart thing to do. And so I think I've had times when I've just felt such loyalty to the people that I believe, you know, have given me this chance, that I just didn't think about myself enough. And so I wish in some ways that I'd just been a little bit more focused and, you know, had my eyes on the prize. And
thought about yourself.
Yeah, because I just believe, you know, business is business. And I deal with things very differently from the way I came up in my own career. You know, if somebody comes to me at Good American and says, hey, Emma, I'm leaving, I'm like, what are you leaving for? Like, where are you going? Not like about to punish right. somebody, and, you know, and guilt trip, or, you know, it's like, this is business. We've all got to do what's best for ourselves mm-hmm. and for our families. And so I think that I'm a very different leader in that way to some of what I experienced on my way.
Got it. Okay. So can you tell us any goals, anything coming up next, anything that you're working on?
Yeah. I mean, one of the things that I'm most proud of right now, and it goes back to this idea of, you know, ignoring rules, which we spoke about a little bit, and listening to customers, because that's something that we always do at Good American. We have invented a whole size, which I think is amazing. And this came from really looking at data. I was looking at returns, as I do a lot. Bad reviews and returns are my thing, because you learn a lot there. And we found that we had literally double, 50% more returns between a size 14 and a size 16 than we do with any other sizes. So I'm trying to understand that. I'm looking at the comments, not really understanding. And you get a lot of like, I don't understand. I bought a 14 and a 16 and I'm too small for a 14, but I'm too big for a 16. I was like, this makes no sense. And when I spoke to design, what I understood was that's where the pattern changes. So I've spoke about this a lot. Good American does 2 and maybe 3 patterns in any garment, because when you shift into what's traditionally known as plus, you're taking a different body type into consideration. And actually what happens is that sizes go up and there are inches between sizes. And when you get to plus, there are more inches between sizes. But where the gap is between the 14 and the 16, you have this huge jump where it not only goes from a traditional straight pattern to a plus pattern, but you've also got more inches there. So this gap of, you know, women is just completely being lost. And I thought, there must be millions of women in this country that are not quite a Missy size 14 and yet not quite a plus size 16. And I was like, we'll just make a new size 15. And my office was like, Emma, that's a junior size here in America and you can't do that. And I was like, no. People will get it. I'll tell them that it's in the middle and we'll just, you know, make the measurements like in between. And so we did. And, you know, I might be sitting here a year later going, wah, size 15, like just crash. But, you know, I think you have to try things. And yeah. I honestly believe that there's this huge vacuum. And so right now I'm into inventing sizes.
Great. I am so into that for you. Okay, last question and then I'll let you go. If you could go back in time and speak with younger Emma, what advice would you give her?
I would tell myself that everything will work out and that actually you should just learn to be a little bit more selfish. And I mean that not in a way, I would never change the way that I behave with people because I think that's one of the things that I'm best at, but I would just think about myself a little bit more. And when I say think about myself, it's like, what actually makes me happy? Not what you think makes a lot of people happy, but like, when do you feel at your best? And when do I feel like I'm doing the you know, the best work? And I would have changed like a few things. Like I definitely wouldn't have stayed at some jobs for as long as I did. And I would have, you know, spent more time like working with my charities, for example. It's like nothing makes you feel better than if you help someone else. And I'm sure that's where that whole favor thing comes as well. It's not purely selfish. It's like you do something nice for someone, like it comes back. It feels lovely. And I think that, you know, some of the charity stuff that I work with now makes me feel so good. And, you know, you just feel different about yourself. And so I would have probably done some of that stuff like a little bit earlier in my life.
That was the founder and CEO of Good American, Emma Greed. For more inspiring interviews with women like Emma, head on over to secondlifepod.com, where we have so many more for you to peruse. If you like today's show, please subscribe on Apple Podcasts or Spotify or wherever you get your podcasts, and don't forget to rate and review us. We love seeing you spread the word on social, and now you can tag us in your posts. We are at Second Life Pod on Twitter and Instagram. We even have a Facebook page, just saying. We always want to know who you'd like to hear from on the show, so send in your requests to hello@secondlifepod.com if you're into email, or you can DM us on Instagram. I'm at Hillary Kerr. The show is at Second Life Pod. Our DMs are always open. I'm Hillary Kerr, and you've been listening to Second Life.
Look around. You can find cars like these on AutoTrader. Like that car riding your tail. Or if you're tailgating right now, all those cars doubling as kitchens and living rooms are on AutoTrader too. Are you working out and listening to this ad at the same time? Well, multitasking pro, cars like the ones in the gym parking lot are for sale on AutoTrader. New cars, used cars, electric cars, maybe even flying cars. Okay, no flying cars, but as soon as they get invented, they'll be on AutoTrader. Just you wait. AutoTrader.